The oceans are important to us in a very many ways. They're a source of resources. They're a medium for transportation and recreation. They are a venue for our national defense. They are also an important source of literal information about the planet. This is Conversations. On this edition of Conversations, we'll take a look at how the oceans can provide information about something important, perhaps in our future, about global warming. Our guest today is eminent oceanographer, Dr. Walter Monk. Dr. Monk, thanks very much for joining us.
Thank you.
I should say that Dr. Monk is at the University of Alaska Fairbanks to give the 1994 Sidney Chapman Memorial Lecture. I want to begin with part of that lecture, if we can, and ask you a question about global warming. I think it will help our entrance to this subject. You said during your lecture that there has been evidence of significant warming on the planet over the last 100 years, and that since 1957, when the first concrete evidence came to scientists' hands, the evidence that has been mounting is tantalizing. What I'd like you to do, if you can, is to use those words, tantalizing and significant, to give us a notion of how you characterize global warming. Is that a fair opening question?
Yes, it is. Well, what happened is in the 1950s, David Keeling of Scripps Institution started taking measurements of CO2 at Mauna Loa volcano in Hawaii. And that time series has continued and is continuing till today. A few years later, a similar station was established in Antarctica at the South Pole. And the way in which it nearly all started is a remarkable time series of CO2 showing a significant change since it was started in 1950. And no one disputes the reality of that recording. It's not temperature, it's CO2, greenhouse gases. And nearly all discussions have their starting point on these measurements and what they infer. Now, you asked about temperature. Temperature measurements, of course, go way back. And various people, including our vice president, who is interested and knowledgeable in that subject, have compiled records of surface temperature over the Earth, both ocean and land. And these show a change since about 100 years ago, 1880, 1890, which is generally considered to be sort of the beginning of the Industrial Revolution, of something like a half a degree centigrade. From then to in 100 years. The time series was obtained by, first of all, averaging all weather stations. There are 10,000 weather stations in the world. That's not altogether satisfactory because there are many more stations in the northern hemisphere than the southern hemisphere. And there are many more stations on land than in the ocean. It's very hard to get a representative average, of course. And many of the weather stations are in places where there have been growing cities. And it's well known that if you have something at an airport and the city grows about it, that you change the microclimate. For example, in Los Angeles, I think in the middle of the city, it's 2 degrees warmer than it's further out. So the data are stacked also by the fact that they are usually located in places where there have been changes in the urban nature. It makes it very difficult to correct for and interpret, and so people argue a lot about it. The ocean temperatures started out being what we call bucket temperatures. People on sailboats would throw a bucket over with a line at the end, and if you throw it over properly, it lands in the water with the open side down, and then you pull it up, and then you put a thermometer in, and you measure it. Of course, different buckets would measure different things because it depends whether you go down 6 inches or 12 inches. It's a very, very difficult thing. And later on, the bucket temperatures have been replaced by what is called injection temperatures. Most ships measure the injection, the water, seawater, which is which is pumped in to cool the engines. As you can imagine, there's a complicated problem to go from that injection temperature to ocean temperature. So that time series is not without some problems. But people who've done it most carefully, I think, generally agree there appears to be something like a half a degree increase in 100 years.
Is there any what I'm hearing from you is that there are concerns about localized information, different methods of testing, different kinds of figures.
Yes.
Is there any question similar to that about CO2 increases or CFC increases?
No, the CO2 was done by a scientist with a technique which was well calibrated, and so the CO2 measurements are really of a much higher standard than temperature measurements. And of course now with certain satellite measurements available in the upper atmosphere, the data is different kinds of things are being measured and it is getting better. But there are still disputes and discussions about the validity of that half degree change. What I find more interesting is that if you plot the CO2 content, which by the way was extrapolated backwards in time from the 1950s when these measurements started all the way to the turn of the century, by using air samples in glaciers, glacial cores. You can drill cores into the Greenland Glacier and you can extract little air bubbles and you can measure the CO2 content in those bubbles. And it looked as if that is a good way to get paleo CO2 measurements. And so people have gone back from when the Mauna Loa observation started all the way to the turn of the century. So you have these two time series, CO2 and average global temperature for 100 years. If things were as simple as possible and CO2 was the only cause, those two curves should look sort of alike, and they don't. The atmospheric temperatures show wide swings from one decade to the next relative to this mean increase of a half a degree, which I mentioned. In fact, there were 20 years from, I think, 1960 to 1980 when the mean temperature was going down. And if you saw nothing else but those 20 years, you'd say, my God, we're getting into another ice age. We better do something about it. So it's a complex problem.
This is Dr. Walter Monk. Today we're looking at global warming, and we're looking at it through the eye of the ocean on Conversations. Tell me what that rise and fall in measured temperature means to you.
Well,
that's too large a question.
The thing that why everybody is so interested in it and why it became a political issue and why Mr. Gore has spent time thinking about it is that if there should be a continuing of this trend, which people generally think might lead to a 5-degree increase at high latitudes, or maybe even 6-7 and somewhat less at lower latitudes, that does have an effect on how people live. It has an effect on agricultural procedures. It may have an effect on cloudiness. In some the sea level will go up probably by a foot or so by the year 2050. And there are some low-lying areas where a foot sea level change makes a lot of difference. If you own a palazzo in the city of Venice, you'd be very concerned. Mm-hmm. The water level has already gone up 6 feet since the year 1500 because of sea level rise, which is due to other causes. But an enhanced sea level rise now would be very troublesome. So there's a lot of interest, and my own feeling is that it's important to do a good prediction, because any ways of doing something about it, like changing the way people get their energy and things, will be slow, will take tens of years, and will be expensive, and you want to be sure you do it in a deliberate and proper way. And so you need to have confidence in your predictions.
I want to work our way towards the the research that you have been planning and attempting and that lies before you. But I have a couple more preliminary questions from a very lay point of view first, if you will. You described in the lecture you gave, the Sidney Chapman lecture, that you described the ocean as being a sink for carbon, heat, and ignorance. I think we're going to be talking more about ignorance as we go along, as the oceans, one of the things the oceans has in it. But tell me about how the ocean is a sink or a trap for carbon and for heat.
Yes, it's a very important trap. If you had a planet Earth without oceans, whatever effect you're going to have would be probably two or three times larger, and would really be very, very much more serious. Most of the carbon that's released into the atmosphere by fossil fuel burning finds its way into the ocean. Most, maybe two-thirds of it. Most of the additional heat that you get from the greenhouse gases finds its way into the ocean. So unless you get the ocean part of this global change correct, you're not going to get the atmosphere correct. I don't think any dispute about that. And I am troubled as an oceanographer by the fact that there are very, very few ocean measurements that would parallel, if you wish, these surface air temperature measurements, which we talked about a few minutes ago. Mm-hmm. These may not be very good, but they're an awful lot better than none. And there is very little body of evidence in the oceans. And I think it's essential if people are going to have any confidence in the predictions, and if any political decisions are to be made for the future, that you have predictions which are, in fact, confirmed by measurements. And I would like to continue along this line sometime if there's a chance during the hour, because that's really the guts of what we're trying to do.
Okay. I have one question, and then I'll just let you do that if you'd like to. The world is so big. The oceans are so many and so big. How do you measure anything to find the answer you seek in all that water that's affected by temperatures and tides and...
That's the challenge. It's not easy. And that's why it hasn't been done. I mean, the reason that these measurements are sparse is that they're difficult. And that's the challenge that I find interesting about it. By the way, I'd like to inject something that I think that you might find amusing and people would find amusing.
Please.
But I mentioned from 1960 to 1980, the temperature was diminishing. And you may not remember, but maybe some people in the audience will remember, there was keen concern that we're entering another ice age. And you could possibly take the view that people have been so incredibly far-sighted and intelligent that they started emitting CO2s from fuels at just the time so they would stop our move towards another ice age. That would be the most optimistic view you can take about people's behavior.
Optimistic and frightening at the same time.
Yes.
We did it too much.
Or maybe we are now going to an ice age and there's a 100-year anomaly and we have to be sure we should put more fuel into the atmosphere.
But I think we're probably doing that, yes. This is Dr. Walter Monk with us on this edition of Conversations. Some background. He was born in 1917 in Vienna. His university and graduate work were all done in the United States. His bachelor's and master's taken from the California Institute of Technology, and his PhD from the University of California. He has been with the University of San Diego throughout his career, beginning as an assistant professor in 1947. He retired in 1982 as a full professor with a number of distinguished appointments behind him. In 1988, he was recalled to Scripps Institute, where he has worked for all these years, and has been there again as professor and researcher. Dr. Walter Monk, our guest on Conversations.
It's not quite correct.
Oh, tell me, please.
If I may correct you. First of all, the important thing is I work at the Scripps Institution of Oceanography, which has been part of University of California since 1906. It started in 1903. UCSD, the general campus at San Diego, is a relative newcomer. We consider it a newcomer. Scripps has been there forever. They just came recently. So I'm really part of Scripps, and I was part of Scripps long before there was a UCSD. Then as far as retiring is concerned, when I became 65 on June 30th, I, by university rules, had to retire and spent a sleepless night, but I was reappointed on 1 July. So there was no six-year hiatus. I just continued doing what I've always done.
Oh, my paperwork is wrong then.
I think so.
Yeah. I had an idea that you had a pleasant hiatus and then returned to work.
But, no, hiatus was one night.
One night.
Pretty awful night.
Well, let's return. An associate of yours, I think it's Mr. Potter, but I'm not quite sure, described the project that you have designed as an ingenious solution to a vexing problem. The vexing problem is where to put the thermometer, how to measure an ocean with so many differences in it. The solution seems to have been to use something the Navy developed to counteract Russian spy ships. Can you introduce us to that?
Yes, that is the key. Well, I think the key is that you don't want to do what people have done for hundreds of years, put a thermometer into the water and measure temperature and go back and do it again and again and again, because you'd find that locally, at any given spot, no matter where you are in the ocean, you find large changes from month to month, like up 1 degree and down 1 degree or something of this kind. And those changes are associated with what is the equivalent of weather in the oceans, like you have storms in the atmosphere, you have eddies in the ocean, and they produce the large variability. But weather is not climate, just not in the atmosphere, not in the ocean. But it produces the big changes from 1 week to the next, as you know. Mm-hmm. Oh. Now, if you made spot measurements, you would be so swamped by these month-to-month weather variability that you would not really have a chance to detect and study the climatic variability, which is on a larger scale. The eddies in the ocean, think of them as very small storms, something like 100 kilometers across, 60 miles. But some of them are warm and some of them are cold. And if you go over many, many eddy diameters, they sort of average out. And what you'd like to do to study climate is to find a way to measure the mean temperature of an ocean basin, not the mean temperature of a given spot, mm-hmm. which is so dominated by that small-scale ocean weather. And so our key interest was, how could we take a measurement which by its very nature was integrating, was averaging over something like an ocean basin, and we thought that the only way of doing that is acoustically. And there are two underlying ideas. One is that the speed of sound is a function of temperature. Sound travels faster in a warmer ocean. So if you put in a signal at some point, acoustic signal, and you measure it at some other point, it takes a certain time to go, the travel time. And if the ocean gets warmer, that travel time would diminish because the speed goes up. So could you, in fact, measure over some period of time what happens, how long? What happens to the acoustic travel time between two fixed points? That's the underlying idea. And you would then measure the average of the intervening water, not just the water temperature at a given point. The second idea is that the ocean is a remarkable transmitter of sound. The oceans are just opposite to the atmosphere, where you depend on radio waves and other electromagnetic waves and light waves. The ocean is opaque to electromagnetic energy. If you go down in a submarine by more than 10 feet, you can't hear the radio station. You can't use radio waves. Light gets absorbed in just 100 feet and it gets almost totally dark. On the other hand, the atmosphere is a poor transmitter of sound. Not very poor, but poor. The ocean is a good transmitter of sound. And we've known for some time that explosions have been heard at very, very long distances in the ocean. So the combination of these two things would suggest then that if you put source and receivers apart by some thousands of miles on the scale of climate changes and measure the travel time of acoustic signals, you would get an integrated measure of temperature that would be much better for studying climate changes than a spot measurement at a single point.
And if you do that over time?
Over calendar time.
Yes.
Travel time over calendar time, it would give you an indication of changes of the intervening water mass, which is much better than if you had a similar time series at one point.
When you sorted that out, you must have been very excited, it seems to me.
It's sort of developed like these things develop. We had been doing it for 10, 12 years on a smaller scale, and it was a kind of a natural development to start saying, could we in fact do that on a basin scale? I should then add to it that acoustic sources and receivers are very expensive in water, and that the Navy has developed a series of acoustic receiving stations, hydrophones, which is the water equivalent of microphones, over the last 30 years at a total cost of about $25 billion, billion, not million, which have been used during the Cold War to try and follow and detect and study and get intelligence on Russian submarines, very, very successfully. Submarines were picked up at distances sometimes exceeding 1,000 miles. And those are assets which exist, have been built at great expense to the American taxpayers, and are well suited for this kind of study that I've mentioned to you. And what I find so interesting is that 2 years ago, 3 years ago, then Senator Gore and Senator Nunn got the idea that maybe with the end of the Cold War, one should see whether some of these existing military assets, not just the acoustic ones, but other assets that we have, intelligence assets, could perhaps be made available for studying problems of interest to society. And they started something called SERDP, Strategic Environmental Research and Development Program, I think, to find out whether such a thing could be done. And I find it an inspiring idea. It's sort of the 20th century equivalent of beating swords into plowshares, isn't it?
Yes.
And so we were an almost ideal example under this notion, under this program. Here are these stations, they've been developed, they're expensive, they're working. Could we use them in this fashion? And we've been very successful working with the Navy in using them. We've used them, in fact, for some years. They're still classified in the sense that positions are not distributed and certain characteristics are not. But we have found it quite possible to use them. And there is now a move underway on a very high level to make them much more easily accessible for studies. And I should add, they're not just for receiving acoustic signals for climate work, which you and I have discussed. They turn out to be excellent for detecting earthquakes under the ocean, better than any existing seismic instrumentation now available. They turn out to be tremendously good for studying marine life, certain marine life in the oceans. You can hear whales at distances of many, many miles, 10, 20 miles. These facilities are very powerful. You can form beams and keep a single whale, you might say, in a sort of a searchlight beam and follow as it moves, listen to the noise they make. They're very talkative. And the Navy people who've used these facilities have long known that they can listen to whales. In fact, they're a nuisance. They kept you from hearing submarines, but weren't able to make that known. And now that these facilities are beginning to be available, some of the marine mammal community in the United States has gotten very exciting results in using them for these studies. So that is underway and is part of what we're talking about.
It's interesting that the process of beating swords into plowshares may create a great many different kinds of plowshares.
I think so.
Yes.
I think so.
On this edition of Conversations, we're looking at global warming. We're looking at it through the eye of the ocean and through the eye of one of the world's most eminent oceanographers, our guest today, Dr. Walter Monk. This project designed to listen to global warming through the ocean is begun and has, Dr. Monk hopes, many years of future ahead of it to provide information about global warming. Just another word about Dr. Monk. He has been the recipient of a number of fellowships for study, three from the Guggenheim Foundation. There is an overseas fellowship some years back with Churchill College. There was a Fulbright and an Australian fellowship, the Senior Queen's Fellowship. His awards have come from many sources, including the most prestigious award from the American Geological Society, from a national a National Medal of Science in 1985, and many others in between. Our guest today on this edition of Conversations is Dr. Walter Monk. I'm Susan McInnes for KUAC. I want to ask you to take a slight deviation, if you will, again to tell a story that you told during the Sidney Chapman Memorial Lecture. And it's about the Navy's hydrophones and a non-military use of them. Some years ago, Dr. Robert Dietz, who is a geologist, gave another Sidney Chapman Memorial Lecture. And the story you told is about him and how he unearthed information that was thought not possible to find. Can you tell that story briefly?
Yes, certainly. That was, I think it's 1952, I've written it down, a Japanese hydrographic research vessel with 31 people aboard, disappeared overnight. And no one could find anything about it. And he, first of all, went to Japan to look at all the records that were available. There was, at the time, a submarine volcanic eruption, which did produce so-called tidal waves. They call them tsunamis. These are long waves in the sea surface. You know all about it. Alaska had its share,
yes,
of tidal waves. And there is a record from ordinary tide gauge stations. And there were other records of atmospheric disturbances. This was a volcanic eruption of a submarine volcano, but some of the volcanic eruption actually reached the surface of the ocean. And this happened when this particular vessel, in fact, was going to that site to study. Then he went back and examined records of two of these Navy stations, which I mentioned, in California, 5,000 miles away from Japan, to see whether he could find any indication of sounds made by the volcanic eruptions. And he did indeed find there were a number of events in each of them, number of events as locally detected by the tidal waves. Each case he could find a matching acoustic event at those hydrophones. And by having two stations, you could triangulate and locate where it happened. And he came up with a convincing evidence, in my opinion, that exactly when the event occurred that led to the destruction of that ship. I think it's important for this reason and the many others I mentioned, the scientific reasons, the learning something about marine mammals, learning about earthquakes, our hope to learn about climate, that these stations should not be closed. There is an active consideration now by the Navy Department to close them. They have fulfilled their most immediate need with the end of the Cold War. The Navy doesn't have all the money it needs. It's suffering under very severe budget cuts, and they naturally are looking for possibilities of saving money. Mm-hmm. We formed a group to attempt to find a way that they could be kept open for at least another 5 years. And I think we have a formula that is perhaps acceptable. There's a big difference in having a station like that fully manned for operational use 24 hours a day, and for having a caretaker operation where you just have individual qualified scientists go in and put in a tape and record it and come back a month later and pick up the tape. We've done our own instrumentation. We only need to go there once a month and change tapes. We can do that quite cheaply. And so a group of oceanographers have gotten together. We've talked to the vice president about it, and talked to other people at a high level. And I hope we will succeed in keeping these stations open, for some of them at least, for some time. That's a particular story.
Yes.
So we get involved in all sorts of curious bylines, if you wish.
Yes. This is Dr. Walter Monk with us on Conversation. I want to pursue, if we can, some curiosities I have about what I think are the logistics of your project. I understand from your explanation, I think, how sound moves and can be tracked, but aren't the oceans noisy, and aren't there just tremendous sounds?
Yes.
And when you hear it, are you hearing it literally or figuratively?
Yes, I think that's a very good question. Oceans are noisy, and at the frequency at which we've been working, which is very low frequency, sort of 60 hertz, like a hum you hear when your electric toaster is out of order. The principal noise in the ocean is actually man-made. It's due to all the shipping in the world, and a ship produces noise which you can hear at 1,000 kilometers, and so the whole ocean is sort of filled with a certain noise level against which you have to make your measurements. Now, when we started, we didn't really know whether we could send signals and receive them over these distances of ocean basin. And the first step in our work was to see whether this could be done. We knew that explosive sources, explosions man-made, volcano-made, earthquakes, have been heard long distances. But from our view, we couldn't use explosive sources. We wanted to use man-made acoustic sources. Mm-hmm. And we didn't know whether they could be heard over these large distances. There had been no such study. And so in 91, again with the help of the Navy, we took some Navy sources, active sources, not receivers now, on a ship to a point in the Indian Ocean, not far from Antarctica, about as far away as you can get from civilization on this earth, much further than the North Pole, and lowered these sources and had people all around the world put hydrophones in the water to see whether they could hear us. And the interesting thing about the location was that there is a direct connection, if you wish, into all of the ocean basins from that point. You can go westward from that point, and you go by the Cape of Good Hope up into the South and North Atlantic, Bermuda, Newfoundland, if it worked. Mm-hmm. You can go eastward between Australia and New Zealand, all the way up to California, Washington, and Alaska. And you could certainly go northward into the Indian Ocean and southward into the Antarctic Ocean. So there was a point where you really, if you wish, illuminate, it should be insonify, all the world's oceans if it would work. And we chose that point. And 12 countries volunteered to go out with their ships and lower hydrophones and see whether they could hear us. And we had instrumented various Navy stations, which we've been talking about, to hear us. But we had no idea whether it would work, and it worked extremely well. We were picked up on both sides of North America, Western and Eastern Path, about the same time. Sound goes 1.5 kilometers per second, so it took about 3.5 hours to go from where we transmitted to where the receivers were. And I'm speaking particularly now of one receiver off Seattle and another one off Bermuda, mm-hmm. two sides of North America, both about the same distance, about 18,000 kilometers, almost halfway around the world. And so we demonstrated that it is possible to use electrically driven sources which can be suitably coded and hear over very large distances.
When you say suitably coded, what does that mean? That's an aspect of hearing here, right?
That's a more complicated thing. What you'd like to do is to put in a single short pulse, sharp pulse, into the water, and you can't do that.
Yes.
You can't put all the energy in. So what you do, and I'm afraid that's going to be a little subtle, is you put in a certain tone. In our case, it was 57 hertz. And every so often, you change the phase, and you sort of like a Morse code.
That's what I was thinking of, yeah.
And you keep on doing that for some time. And then at the receiver, you correlate your signal with just that code, and you can show that it's equivalent to having sent a single spike, only instead of sending a spike in a hundredth of a second, put all the acoustic energy in, you spread it, the same amount of energy, over 1 hour. But the effect, when properly done, is almost the same. And that's an important point, because the level of sound at any time is then very low. None of the marine mammals could hear you, as we have said. But when you analyze it in the proper way, you get essentially the equivalent of a very, very high, loud single pulse.
I'm glad you mentioned marine mammals for two reasons. One is that listeners at this point must have a curiosity about an effect on life forms underwater. And the other is that that is a springboard into a media-created controversy, inadvertently, I should think, media-created controversy, that almost derailed your project.
Yes, I think that's correct.
I wonder if this is a good time to introduce that subject.
Yes. Well, it first came up at this other experiment I mentioned in the Indian Ocean. We were off an island, an uninhabited Australian island called Heard Island. Heard is H-E-A-R-D.
A well-named island.
Not because you were heard, but because Captain Heard, an American sea captain, discovered it. And there was a concern, and we had along on that expedition a party of nine marine biologists who could mount a watch and observe and listen around the clock when we were doing that work to see whether we were causing any damaging effect. And that turned out to be all right. There were no signs. The technical word is of distress. Distress would be if a whale would suddenly surface and jump out of the water and things like that. It's a pretty extreme reaction. And on the basis of our very good reception from Heard Island, we lowered our expected source level by a factor of almost 1,000. We thought we could do with much less energy and therefore would be much less disruptive. And on that basis really thought that since we had not caused any observable distress at Heard Island, that going down by a large factor would mean that it would be satisfactory. But that turned out not to be the case. For some reason, we became known, and there was developed a suddenly, with a specific newspaper article, I think, a very large and widely reported concern that we were going to do widespread damage to marine mammals in the area of the acoustic sources. And this has led to us having to go through certain review processes which we had never gone through before and which we did not think would be required. And we're in the process of attempting to be reviewed and attempting to get necessary permits.
If I may, my understanding is that the LA Times article to which you're referring was a product of misunderstanding the data and not following it up, not going to Scripps, to you, or to Andrew Forbes or the other people involved in the project and saying, what does this word mean?
Yes.
What are you going to be doing here? What do these sound levels mean? Is that
I think
your
that's
sense?
A fair statement. I think I do want to say that there is a legitimate concern. We are putting noise in the water. It's not enormous. It's about the same as a large tanker puts into the water. So we're one of 10,000 noisemakers. And unlike the tankers that operate 24 hours a day, we would operate only a small fraction of the time. We don't need to be turned on. We would be turned on 2% of the time, eventually. So it's not a unique, but there is a problem, and we're a little different than ships, and people should be concerned. And from the very beginning, we arranged our present set of experiments to be done in conjunction with experts in the field of marine, of the effect of noise, effect of sound on marine mammals. And we have two partners who are, I think, widely respected as being the leaders in that field, a professor, Chris Clark at Cornell University, and a professor, Dan Costa at the University of Santa Cruz. And they have been working with us hand in hand in trying to work up a protocol so that in the event that there should be some problems, that we would know about it. And if those problems are severe, we would have to stop. We couldn't do it. But what happened in that newspaper article was entirely different. What happened is that a young woman who was then at Cornell, who is an expert on sperm whales, produced a electronic mail information which essentially said to anyone who read it that we were going to kill hundreds of thousands of whales. And that statement was wrong.
Yes.
Our source level is, in more familiar units, 250 watts acoustic. That's not a very large amount of watts. It's not a loudness which would cause physical damage, but it might cause behavioral changes, which in the long run could have a negative effect, but not, as it was originally claimed, the deafening or even killing of hundreds of thousands of marine mammals. And it was that original telegram, plus her interview with a non-science reporter in the Los Angeles Times, which spread the same piece of disinformation, that started a very large reaction of people writing thousands of letters to the U.S. government, to our sponsors, to our senators, to our congressmen, saying that this horrible thing must be stopped before hundreds of thousands of marine mammals are killed. That part has now gone away. I think that the mistake, there was a mistake in the acoustic calculation, an outright mistake by a factor of 1 million, that has been withdrawn. The Los Angeles Times did publish a second article a month later, again to their credit on the first page, in which they, I think, represented the situation fairly. But once we were forced into a sort of a permit response that we hadn't thought was necessary, there's apparently no way of reversing that. And we are in the process of following through and hoping that we will eventually succeed in getting permits.
Can I ask you about that permit process? You've, I would guess, spent some part of your professional life writing proposals and doing pre-project research to make sure a project is feasible or acceptable in other areas. What's your assessment of the the kind of environmental impact study and statement process and permitting process that you have been forced into. The reason I'm asking this is a lot of people will say the federal government is tying science's hands, forcing us into stumbling blocks that are ill-advised.
No, I think they need to do that. I mean, there has to be some control. We thought that, considering that we play such a relatively minor role as compared to shipping, as compared to underwater drilling, as compared to any number of other activities, that we didn't deserve to be quite so singled out in the permit process as we have. And we were certainly singled out as a result of a public outcry,
right,
which I think was based to a large part on misinformation. I'm not a biologist, you didn't say that. I'm really not an expert on the effect of acoustics on marine mammals, though by circumstances I've had to learn something about it. But I think we were a relatively minor component, and we're the only one of these components who have voluntarily offered to use part of our funds, our research funds, to go in partnership with some very respectable and knowledgeable marine biologists so that we can be sure that we're doing the job in a responsible way. And I think you need to give me the opportunity then to respond not to the physical damage problem, which I think was what started it all but is not the significant issue, but whether the behavioral effect in the long run could in fact be a very negative thing. That is the real issue.
Please do.
And that is what is being studied. At the two sites, observations have been made now for 2 years at Kauai, so that you establish a norm. The principal problem there is the marine mammal, the whale problem. And we have some assessments of the population density there before we start any sources. And the plan now is that before the acoustic sources are to be used for the climate study, going onto a certain schedule, that the sources are to be used by the two biologists with whom we are in partnership to make a series of tests, including playbacks to the whales, to try and see what the reactions are, whether in fact some of their species, whale species, can even hear us at the very low frequencies, and to learn something before we go into a regular schedule of transmissions. And I think that is the key problem. Are we going to cause any significant changes in the local population? It's a very difficult problem, and one that one can really only learn by trying.
On this edition of Conversations, we're talking with Dr. Walter Monk. We haven't yet named the project, and we should. It is called the Acoustic Thermometry of Ocean Climate Project. Tell me what thermometry means.
And we use the abbreviation ATOC.
ATOC, yeah.
Well, thermometry means to measure temperature, and we measure temperature not by using a mercury thermometer, but by using acoustics. So the word is sort of new, but I think it's a good word. So we're doing acoustic thermometry, and the purpose of our work is to learn something about ocean climate.
Yes.
And so we use those four words. And I hate acronyms. I'm a member of an anti-acronym society, but in this instance, we were forced to since four long words, to go down to a horrible acronym called ATOC.
I think you've mentioned sometime in the last hour, certainly you did during your lecture, that you thought the immediate ATOC project would last for, I think, 2.5 years.
Yes.
But that you hoped it would go on for decades.
Yes, we need to show whether it works. We need to show whether it can be done without causing damage to the local marine life. And we would like to, at this time, consider only a set of problems that have to be solved. If we are successful, and if SIRDIP, which I mentioned before, is willing to continue supporting us. And they have their concerns now because of the concerns of the other activities. Then we would like to look forward to establishing some additional sources in other oceans, certainly in the Atlantic, in the Arctic, which is a key place. And there have been some experiments in the Arctic and in the Indian Ocean. And we have a very international group. We meet once a year. We've been set back by the present permit process because the United States has been the leader. But we could see our way clear for having similar measurements made in other parts of the world, which I think would be necessary.
Dr. Monk has mentioned a number of nations. There are 11 institutions and 7 nations worldwide that have joined together to cooperate in this project. Is that level of cooperation remarkable or expectable in this day of science?
I think it's been better than good. We actually, for the Heard Island experiment, I didn't even think of asking anyone. We were going to use just Navy receivers and a few of our own. And it became international by the old boys' network. No formal organization whatsoever. Somebody would write in and say, I hear you're going to set off some sound off Heard Island, and we could get a ship out to listen. Before we knew it, we had, I hope I will not make a mistake, but we had Australia, New Zealand, Russia, India, Canada, France, at Kerguelen Island I only have 6, Japan.
And you.
And I'm missing 2. Whom am I missing?
The United States.
United States, well.
There would be us.
and all collaborating on a personal basis, not government basis. The oceanographers are somewhat of a small group of people who know each other, and that's the most effective way possible. Someone says, well, I can get one of our ships to go out and we'll go and hang a hydrophone on and listen to you. And so it was a very positive experience to see that happen.
We have relatively few minutes left, about 5, and I can't leave without asking you what your predictions and hopes are for this project. If we have the information you hope to get, what then?
Well, we are planning for open sea transmission far away from shore. I need to tell you that we need 3 kinds of permits, one from the U.S. government, one from the state of Hawaii, one from the state of California, who are immediately concerned. We plan for a transmission in the open water several hundred miles offshore from San Diego, which requires only a government permit now, not the state permits. We're planning to transmit for 10 days in November and to listen in at the stations, at the Navy stations, which have been instrumented, as well as 2 special receivers which we have built, which are all constructed. This is more or less to learn something more about certain acoustic propagation problems, which we do not understand. Mm-hmm. There are problems that need to be understood. It's not a climate problem. It's a sort of an engineering propagation test. We're hoping that the permit process will wind through by sometime late spring 1995. As soon as that happens, we're ready to connect these sources to an electric cable from shore so that they can be continued to be powered, and we're all ready to go to work. We've lost so much time by now that the project formally comes to an end just when we get started. We feel a little like King Pyrrhus of Epirus, if you recall, who said, one more such victory and I'm lost.
And I'm lost.
We may have a victory and then we're lost. So we have trying very hard to persuade SIRDIP and other government groups, since we've lost a year at least, to give us a chance to continue for at least another year and a half so we can get our data and see what's to be done.
Over the long term, permits in hand, project having gone for several years, what do you hope to know that we don't know now?
Yeah, I think that's really the key question, which we sort of avoided. I think, you should think of it this way. Weather prediction nowadays, weather, not climate, is being done on computer models, atmospheric models. It works pretty well. But there was a period when models were first being used when it didn't work well at all. It actually was less well done than it had been done by hand for about 10 years. And it was not until observations taken at different weather stations were properly assimilated into the prediction process that the prediction became any good. If you had no true data go into these models, they would lose their meaningfulness in 12 days. The prediction would be useless. Now, there's a similar aspect to climate prediction. We need to make the measurements, feed them back into these models. If the models work well, then you have some credibility. If they work poorly, we need to find out, as it was in the case of weather prediction, why there was a problem. The models will need to be improved. In some period of time, they would then become acceptable and reliable. And that would be climate, not only greenhouse-oriented. We've emphasized greenhouse too much. There are many climatic variations which have nothing to do with greenhouse, like, for example, El Niño, which has to do with certain wind situations. The idea is simply to make observations in the oceans and the atmosphere to improve the climate modeling until we feel that it has reached a stage of reliability. Mm-hmm. And a better climate model for the natural climate change is a better climate model for the anthropomorphic change. And our goal is really to work with the climate modeling community and help produce something that would have credibility and could be used for national policy.
This is the experiential, hands-on research that goes hand in hand with the modeling.
Yes.
Yes. Dr. Monk, thank you for a fascinating hour. I think we've learned a great deal. Thanks. This has been Conversations on KUAC FM. We've been talking with Dr. Walter Monk. He is the 1994 Sidney Chapman Memorial Lecturer. It is a request and an honor given to an eminent scientist once a year by the University of Alaska Fairbanks. It has been a great pleasure to have Dr. Monk on campus and in the studios of KUAC. Thanks again.
Thank you for asking such kind questions.
My pleasure, truly. This has been Conversations. I'm Susan McGinnis, and I hope you join me again next week.